Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 15 for June 15th, 2011. David Bradley. Triangulation is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, our 15th episode in the continuing series of conversations with big thinkers. Oh, wait a minute.
That was a different show. You mean Titans of Tech.
Wait, we can't call it that either. But we have interviewed some really interesting people. Tom Merritt is with me, and it's always fun. This time is a little history. One of the things that our audience always enjoys is looking back at the history of computing. And there was no more important announcement or invention in the history of computing, I think, than the IBM PC. Apple took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal that said, "Welcome, IBM. Seriously."
It's about time. Thank you for joining us.
In fact, they probably regretted that bitterly.
Yeah, I think so.
Our guest today was one of the 12 engineers who worked on the original IBM PC in Boca Raton. He's the guy who did arguably the thing that was perhaps the most important part of the IBM PC, the BIOS, the ROM BIOS. And the reason that was important, it was because that was the thing that was copied by the clone makers that allowed them to make IBM PC compatibles, and thereby was an industry born.
And every Windows-based computer you use has a BIOS.
Still does. Still does. He also gets some credit, I don't know right or wrong, we're going to ask him, for the three-finger salute. Control-Alt-Delete. I don't know if that's really what he wants to be remembered for, but we'll find out in just a bit when we talk to David Bradley, one of the original IBM PC 12, the Dirty Dozen, as some have called them. Hey, before we get to David, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Netflix.
Netflix?
You ever hear of them?
I have. I've watched several episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer recently on Netflix Instant Streaming.
That's kind of what I like about it, is that like you don't have to plan ahead. You don't have to even think about what you're going to watch tonight. I don't know what I'm going to watch tonight, but I know it will be something cool, and it will most likely be on Netflix. I did that last night. Jennifer says, "Let's watch a movie." And now I could go to – I did, in fact, and this is stupid of me. I went to, you know, the cable video on demand, and it's crap, and it's $7 or $8 –
right.
Or more. And it's just like, and so then I fired up the Roku and bada bing, bada boom. There's tons to watch. Look at Queen, The Making of a Night at the Opera. That would be fun to see.
Modern Marvel's computers.
Look at this stuff. I tell you. Here's the deal. This is $7.99 a month. Less, you know, like one video on demand movie and you get unlimited all month. Great quality. It plays on your computer, your Mac, or your PC, but it also plays on a lot of other devices, including an Xbox 360, a PS3, a Nintendo Wii,
Roku, sure. A Google TV,
a lot, Apple TV. A lot of TVs themselves just do it right now. I watch it on my Roku box. That's how I really like to watch
it. We have the Roku box in the main room for it. Although the Xbox is also set up for it. And then we have Google TV, Logitech Review in the bedroom. So we can get it both places.
Just fantastic. TV shows.
Zombieland, Star Trek, Lord of the Rings,
Pulp Fiction. Did you like Zombieland?
I did. I thought it was funny. You didn't like it?
It's a little too violent for me. But see, here's the thing. That's the beauty of it. Yeah. You can start a movie and there's no investment.
If you want to, like, you know what? I'm out. I want to go watch X-Men instead. You
right.
can go switch to that.
And if you're halfway through a movie and you stop, you can pick it up anywhere because your Netflix account, it's good everywhere. So I can continue the movie at work, later, whatever. Just love it. I just want you to try it. I know most of you are already members. So here's what you want to do. You want to go to netflix.com/twit for a 30-day trial. If you are not already a member, if you are, tell your friends, help us out here at Triangulation. If you like the show, you can help us out.
Here's what you go over to their house. You say, hey, let's watch a movie.
Sign up.
And then you start critiquing everything that they do to watch a movie because it's so difficult.
Yeah.
Because it will be. Yeah. And then you say Netflix.com/twit. We'd never have to go through this again.
Free for 30 days. And then $7.99 a month. You could even give it to him as if you really liked him.
Yeah, it's a great gift. It's a Father's Day, you know.
Next Perfect week. Father's Day gift.
This weekend.
Netflix.com/twit. Please, I beg of you, go there. I beg of you, do it for me. Do it for Tom. Do it for Triangulation.
Do it for good old IBM PS2 3286 here.
Okay. He's with us. Everybody be now suitably worshipful. David Bradley is here. Somehow I don't think he wants the worship. He's a classic engineer. Dave, thanks for joining us on Triangulation.
Thanks for inviting me. This is great.
David also wrote the Simon & Schuster's, and I actually own this book. In fact, if I had thought about it, I would have brought it in, Assembly Language Programming for the IBM Personal Computer. You have, according to Wikipedia, 7 U.S. patents.
I think that there's actually a few more than that, a couple issued in my last couple of years. Somebody had actually entered into Wikipedia my bio at one of my speaking engagements.
Oh, they pasted it in.
I think the number's closer to 10, but...
That's awesome.
Okay.
So let's start before the PC. Did you dream in high school of being an engineer?
Yes, I wanted to be an engineer when I was in high school. Very good at math, very good at science. They gave you these aptitude tests.
Yeah.
And so 99th percentile math, 99th percentile science, 6th percentile art, 7th percentile sales. So I figured selling art was not a place I wanted to go.
You know what I think is great, David? You remember that.
Yeah.
It made an impression.
Yes.
You thought, I know I'm not doing that. So where'd you go to college?
I went to the first 4 years at the University of Dayton, and then I got my PhD from Purdue in 1975.
Big Ten.
In electrical engineering?
Electrical engineering. Probably would have been computer engineering nowadays, but back then it was only electrical engineering. But my thesis or dissertation was on taking a bunch of microprocessors and turning it into a full-scale parallel processor.
Ooh. Wow. So how'd you get to IBM?
Well, 1975, there weren't too many people hiring. It was a recession year, much like today, although perhaps not as bad. And IBM had a special hiring program for PhDs as different from their normal hiring stuff. And so a PhD recruiter came in and talked to me at Purdue. And then he was from Yorktown Heights, which is where IBM Research is located. Mm-hmm. But then I get a call from Boca Raton, Florida, asking me to come down and interview. And I had no idea that IBM had a facility down there. But figured out where it was, flew down, talked to him, and they offered me a job. So that was a good deal.
What was Don Estridge already down there, or was that later?
Well, when I went down there, it was to work on the Series 1.
Oh, yeah.
Which was IBM's mini computer. I worked in an ad tech group. In fact, I did some early cache design for the Series 1 type stuff. Don Estridge at that time was the manager of the operating system work for the Series 1. Which I think they ended up calling the real-time programming system, something like that. RTPS sticks in my mind. But that's 1975, 1976, time like that.
So the personal computer revolution is just beginning around this time. Were you aware of that, the MITS Altair and similar systems?
Yes, I was an early subscriber to Byte Magazine, and I owned a digital group, which I put together during Super Bowl XII.
What is a digital group?
Digital group was one of the many flavors of personal computer you could buy back then. It was not an S100 machine.
It was Z80 based, right?
Actually, you could get any kind of processor card you wanted for it. I got a Z80, but you could get your 6800.
But it was a build it yourself, like a Heathkit sort of
How
situation.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. You had to know which end of the soldering iron got warm in order to own a digital group.
And so did you think that this was going anywhere? I mean, here you are, you're working on minis, you're working on much more sophisticated stuff. Were these toys at the time to you?
Well, here's a part of the story you probably don't know. Around 1977, we started paying attention to these personal computers. I think it was because IBM salesmen were going into accounts where 360 was running the business, and they saw people with personal computers on their desks. Not many, not doing a whole lot.
Right.
But your previous guest, Dan Bricklin, sort of changed that with VisiCalc.
That's right.
Suddenly, there's a reason to own personal computers. So now IBM gets a little bit interested. And so in February of 1978, I was one of the original engineers working on the System 23 Data Master, which you've probably never heard of before.
No.
But it was the system that IBM did in order to learn how to do a personal computer. It's got an Intel 8085 as its microprocessor.
Oh, interesting.
Which was the first use of a non-IBM microprocessor in any development organization. Before that, IBM designed their own microprocessors. So we did that. We wrote our own basic interpreter, wrote our own operating system for it, and it was a big, boxy kind of thing. It had 8-inch diskette drives, a 12-inch monochrome display, and a keyboard, all integrated in one big box. And the things that we learned doing that were the predecessors to the IBM PC. We learned what to do, what not to do. There, that's a Data Master picture. Excellent.
That's pretty cool.
By the way, take a look at that keyboard. That is the same in layout, although not in keycaps, as the keyboard for the original IBM PC.
Same sculpted keys. They look very familiar. You got the function keys on the left.
Yeah, the same buckling spring technology that everybody loved.
Those great old keyboards.
Now, according to Wikipedia, the Data Master was announced a month before the IBM PC. Did they just take, well, we've spent all this research, we might as well put it out as well? How did you end up coming out with both of those?
There were a lot of problems in the development of the Data Master. One of them was writing our own basic interpreter, something that we wanted to fix when we went to do the PC. The other thing was there were some design problems in the Data Master, not to point any fingers, but the Intel 8302 dynamic memory controller had 7 distinct problems that they took a long time to get fixed back then. And so when we designed the PC, it did not use a dynamic memory controller to keep the RAM refreshed. It used a very different methodology.
And so, did you get pulled over from the Data Master to the PC? Did people start to see some of these problems and say, hey, let's make a second attempt at the same time?
Well, in the meantime, the personal computer industry is going on. Apple II is the first appliance computer. You plug it in and it works. You don't have to build it yourself. So there are some evangelists within IBM. Bill Lowe being probably the most famous of them. Mm-hmm. He was the system manager for the Data Master. Everybody on Data Master worked for him. And he came along and pushed the corporation very strongly to, we need a personal computer offering, something to counter Radio Shack and Apple, something that we can sell into our accounts. So with that evangelism and a task force that ran during the summer of 1980, in September of 1980 or thereabouts, Frank Carey, the CEO of IBM at the time, said, we're going to build a personal computer. You people in Boca are going to do it. Bill Sidney's was the engineering manager, or named the engineering manager, and he got what we would call in the parlance golden badges. He got to pick 10 or 11 different people. You know, he got the first round draft picks, if you will, throughout all the organization. So he took the people from Data Master that he wanted. And after the original meetings with Microsoft, they realized there was a boilerplate appendix in the standard agreement with Microsoft to get their basic interpreter. It said, you have to supply these interfaces. Read a key from the keyboard, write a character to the screen, print a character, things like that. And so they said, we need somebody to write this. And since I had written essentially all of the diskette, printer, keyboard, interface code for the System 23 Data Master, Bill Sidney's got me to come over to the group. So that's how I ended up as one of those original 12 engineers at PC.
And that's the BIOS, right? The basic input-output system.
Basic input-output system. That's correct.
It's how the computer talks to the drive, how it talks to the keyboard.
The diskette drive, the printer, the keyboard, the graphics adapters. We had two of them on the original PC.
It's not the operating system. The operating system talks to the BIOS.
Right.
It makes requests of the BIOS.
And the original agreement with Microsoft is we don't want to muck around directly with your hardware.
Right.
Just give us an interface that says read this track off the diskette. Or read this sound.
That was actually very smart of Microsoft. I don't know if they thought about it, but by doing so, they made it possible to make clones. If somebody could just give them the same interrupt interface.
Yes.
They could. You could make a clone.
Yes, you could, as long as you provided those same functions at the same software interface. Something that we tried to make feasible, not for the purpose of cloning us, but because IBM, even with all their resources, doesn't have the capability of developing all the hardware adapters and writing all the programs that people are going to want for PCs. So we published the BIOS listing so you could read the interface specifications.
You published the listing?
Yeah, the purple PDB, pastel denim binder.
Yeah.
Don't you remember those?
Yeah.
There are 5x7 pages inside, and then the binder was a little bit bigger than that, and the purple ones were the technical reference manuals. So
wow.
We published the BIOS listing. We published the whole schematic for the IBM PC.
So there wasn't at the time the thought that, oh, this could somebody could take this from us. We want to own this. We don't want anybody to make clones. Wasn't there the awareness that that made it possible?
I certainly wasn't thinking about that. I can't tell you what Don Estridge and the managers who reported to him were because, see, they were up here and
right.
I'm way right. down here.
You were just writing the code. You were just doing the work.
Basic input output.
Yes, I was out there in the lab 10, 12 hours a day.
Well, as it turned out, it was the best thing that could happen to the world because by doing so, by making your BIOS, the BIOS you wrote, clonable, they made the whole industry, created a whole industry, and finally created a whole a world.
Yeah, although I believe that the reason that IBM did it, why they chose to publish that information, was to get the rest of the industry to participate, writing programs,
sure.
developing plug-in adapters.
Sure.
And if they had considered cloning, which in retrospect, should have seemed inevitable because remember the MITS Altair and its S100 bus got cloned almost immediately.
That's right.
So history should have said, well, the clones are going to appear.
Now, another thing that helped along the way was choosing the Intel 8088 processor. Do you know why that choice was made over an in-house processor?
The primary reason was time to market. The goal was get this thing out in a year.
Yeah, because I'm thinking calendar. You said September 1980, you got the go.
Yep.
This came out when? In June 81? What was the year?
Oh, announced on August 12th, 1981.
August. So it was less than a year later, you had a computer.
And the first ones were shipped in October of 1981. So we either made it or didn't make it, depending upon how you want to. Slice it there.
This wasn't a day. It's nail biting.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't the day and age where you'd say, well, we'll take a video card from that stack and an audio card from that stack. We'll get a couple of motherboards here. We got a computer. You'd start from scratch.
A clean sheet of paper is the way an engineer would say it.
Clean sheet.
Which
of paper.
Was a great deal. You know, we got to design the whole thing.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be the same as anything else.
Is this a. I'm looking at. I don't know if this is the breadboard for it or not. Is that the.
Well, that's the backside of we built three wire wrap boards of the original motherboard of the PC. That's the backside of the one that was actually delivered by me and a couple other guys to Microsoft December 1st, 1980.
No kidding.
Showed up at their door a little before 8 o'clock. Steve Ballmer's the guy who let us in.
No kidding.
So he's gone from receptionist to CEO.
He's doing all right. Get that kid, that Ballmer kid. Holy cow. So you brought them three wire wraps so that they could start working?
No. That's the only one we brought them. Only two of them ever worked.
My God.
You know, take a look at that. But that's the one that we took to them. We kept one in Boca to work on it. Now, 2-3 weeks later, we actually had the printed circuit boards. You know, they finally came in, and we went out there and updated their system. That's the front side where all the stuff would plug in. You can see the beginning of the ISA bus there in the upper right-hand corner.
So let's talk about the BIOS, because that's I'm not sure which chip that is. Maybe that's this chip here. It's one of these.
No, we'd have to go. I did not send you the picture of the original system board. The BIOS would have gone, see that stack of 24-pin right now, a little bit to the right of that, one over.
The ROMs here. There's the ROMs.
Yeah, that's where the ROM BIOS and remember, there was 32K bytes of BASIC in ROM in
that's
the original
right.
IBM PC. You could buy a system with no diskette drives.
That's right.
Turn the thing on. You could run BASIC and use your cassette tape.
Cassette. It had a cassette port. Program.
Yes.
The original PCs.
Yep.
Had a cassette port. Does your cassette port on your... Tom brought his PS2, his first PC in here.
And no cassette port on it.
No cassette
this
port.
Has a... This doesn't even have a 5 1/4-inch floppy.
It has a
diskette,
sprung
in 1989 for the 3 1/2-inch.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, the original PC, but it was made out of that great steel, those buckling springs. That thing was solid.
Well,
you love that. Yeah. That was a heck of a piece of hardware, man.
It was wonderfully designed. It was...
Over-designed, you know, some might say.
Oh, yeah. It's still in the IBM tradition that this thing is going to work if you pound on it with a sledgehammer.
So how did, and I got to ask you, I know you don't want to be known as the father of Control-Alt-Delete, but David, I got bad news for you.
That was the Jeopardy question.
That's right. You are a Jeopardy question, so I think you have
actually a Jeopardy answer.
Yes, right. Did Watson get that one?
I'm going up to Yorktown Heights tomorrow. I'm going to ask the research guys about that and find out if they ever ask Watson that question.
Oh, so are there going to be some... Now, one of the reasons David's here, actually there's many, but one of the reasons is because tomorrow is the 100th anniversary of the founding of International Business Machines, IBM. So are you going up there for ceremonies?
I got a special invitation auto-penned by Sam Palmisano.
Well, have fun at that.
Sure, I'll come up.
That sounds very exciting, and it's kind of amazing. I mean, I can't remember who did it. One of the online publications, maybe Business Insider, asked how many companies in the tech industry today will make it 100 years. Microsoft was not on that list. It's 100 years in technology is a lifetime.
I mean, there were three companies that made things like electric tabulating machines,
right,
who came together June 16th, 1911, to form the Computing Tabulating Recording Company.
That was the original
Which was
name.
Then changed later to International Business Machines, just
they
a couple years later.
They made time recording equipment. They made butcher scales.
Yeah, the butcher scale, what was the name of it? I had it here. The computing scale, because it computed a number.
Wow.
Not because it was a computer.
Right.
The way we think of it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And... when I was in grade school, the clocks on the wall said IBM on them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And those are the ones that would tick so slowly, I remember.
they would tick all at once.
They would
move a minute at a
chunk.
Time.
Yeah, I remember that very well, but it just never, the minute always seemed
never
to be longer.
Never went as fast as other clocks when they were in the school.
So how did Control-Alt-Delete come about?
Well, it was really just a simple solution to a problem we had in development. Because early in 1980, people are writing programs for the IBM PC, like accounts payable and accounts receivable and all sorts of stuff like that. And new hardware, new software, it would always hang up. That's just the way it is. Once it hangs up, the only way out of it is to turn off the power, wait a few seconds, turn the power back on, and it goes through this long power on self-test. We didn't have a reset key because there was no convenient place to put one, and... you really didn't want somebody to hit one of those by accident.
No, good point.
Right. So decided, let's do a 3-finger operation so you won't do it by mistake. You know, because this is a drastic action. It's the equivalent of turning off the power.
Not in the middle of your cassette save. You don't want to be hitting that by accident.
No, you don't want to be hitting it by accident. Because of space restrictions in the ROM BIOS, two of the keys had to be shift keys. So Control and Alt are the least frequently used, or the newest, if you will, for a typewriter. And then Delete's all the way over on the other side. And at this point, if you can find the picture of the original IBM PC keyboard.
I sure can.
Illustrate this point. Because it doesn't look like the keyboards you're familiar with today. There's a single control key and a single alt key over on that left-hand side. And then the delete key is all the way over on the right-hand side, down at the bottom.
There it is. There you go. I couldn't find it right away.
Yeah, because yeah, there's not a dedicated delete key. It's still sharing it with the period.
Yeah.
Now, I could have used the enter key, which is over there even further, but it's such a big key. You would like to keep it to a small key.
Yeah.
Plus, delete's a better mnemonic for what's about ready to happen.
Right.
So I did that, 9 lines of code, stuck it into the BIOS, and there's the nine lines of code.
Did you do it more for yourself to just save you time and debugging, or were you thinking this is something you wanted to leave for end users to use as well?
No, it was really intended for me and then all the people who were writing programs for us at the time. Let's put it in for them. For me, we had in-circuit emulators where you took out the 8088 and you plugged in this huge blue box so you could take over entirely the 8088. It was... So I didn't need it, but the people out there writing programs. The other thing in those 9 lines of code, it stores a flag into memory so that when you come back aground on the power on self test, that flag is there. It skips all the memory testing and therefore goes a lot faster. You get back to where you were a lot faster.
You put a reset flag.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4.
And then you jump to start. Start says, whoa, it's a reset, and you do post.
Well, later on, it reinitializes all the chips, but it also checks that. So it was originally intended just to help us out, all the people who are working with us. But now you're writing the publications. You're telling somebody how to start a program. And remember, in those days, it was you took the diskette with VisiCalc on it, you put it in the machine, and you turned it on. And it booted DOS, which was part of your installation of VisiCalc. You actually copied DOS over onto the VisiCalc diskette.
Yes.
And so it would boot DOS, and VisiCalc would come up. And then you wanted to switch to EasyWriter. You had to do that again.
Yeah.
People explaining how to do this said, well, just put the EasyWriter diskette in.
Sys-C, right? Sys-C. I remember that. S-Y-S, so, right?
Oh, the sys key did not come along until the...
But wasn't the DOS command to to put a system on a disk? You'd sys-C.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. C drive.
Yes, you are correct.
Or sys-A, actually, is probably what you'd do, because you didn't have a C drive.
Or B, if you were
sys-B.
A really high roller and you had
two floppies.
Yes.
I can't... You know, that just shows you how these things, like Control-Alt-Delete, get in your brain. I can't believe I can remember the DOS command to write a system on a floppy. I mean, how long has it been since I did that? But you never forget it, do you? It's there.
I have muscle memory of all the keyboard shortcuts.
Of course.
I use all the time. Not that I don't like mice.
I still remember dot commands from WordStar.
Yep.
Now, this is for the geekier members of our audience, but were there any other key combos that you came up with? Like Control-Alt-Insert, was that you?
No, that was done later on.
In fact, Control-Alt-Delete stopped being really reset. It's not anymore, anyway.
No, Bill Gates co-opted it.
Yeah, when Windows took it over.
Yeah.
Which they needed to do because they wanted to intercept that so they could try and exit gracefully from where they were.
Right. Yeah, you don't want a sudden system reboot.
But if you get out your System 23 Data Master, it has a similar but different three-key combination in it that'll get you into a debugger. I can't remember which three keys it is now, but it's like invoking debug on the DOS diskette. You know, so you can see what's in the registers. You can print out memory location, stuff like that. And I wrote that for the Data Master, and so a three-key combination was...
I got a man who owes you a lot of money. He is a host on one of our shows. He wrote a program. His name is Steve Gibson. He wrote a program called SpinWrite, which takes advantage of Int13, as I remember. And that's the disk read interrupt.
Yep.
And he made his living on that Int13 for a long time.
Still does.
That's the amazing thing. Int 13 is still there.
Yes. It's, as an example, one of the first published, not one of the original programs for the IBM PC, but when we started doing that self-publishing thing, Personal Editor 2, PE2.
Yeah.
I still have a copy of it, and I still use it every once in a while, and it still runs just fine.
Because it's all interrupt-driven.
Yeah, it's more DOS.
DOS.
And interrupt, stuff like that. We use the interrupts, since you ask a geeky question. We use the interrupts because that allowed us to modify that code on the fly rather than having to issue a new ROM module if we ever needed a little fix on it. And so if you remember back in the old days of command line interfaces where people put in place programs that would remember previous command line entries so you didn't have to retype the entire thing.
Right.
That came about because they were taking over the keyboard interrupt.
Oh, interesting.
The software interrupt that got you to the keyboard so that they could offer other things along the keyboard line. We used that when we went to the XT in order to boot interrupt 19. X is the boot. And what we did was put a ROM module on the fixed disk adapter card that sort of took over interrupt 19 so it would boot from the fixed disk rather than from the diskette.
So that you could say interrupt 19 was a jump point and then modify the code it jumped to? Is that how it worked?
Well, there actually was a little table down.
It's a jump table. Okay.
Yeah, well, in fact, those are software interrupts as part of the 8080 or 808X architecture has got a bunch of software interrupts down in low memory.
Right.
And all you had to do was change the address down there to point at something else.
Got it.
And we built that in on purpose. That's one of the things we got right as we did it. It allowed a great deal of expansion and flexibility and customization take place. Intel was not happy, by the way, with our choices of interrupts for that.
Why not?
Well, remember the 8186?
Yeah.
Probably. It was sort of an all-in-one computer, and they had used those software interrupts for functions in the 186.
Oh.
And I had used them, and they said, why'd you pick those? You weren't supposed to. And I said, but DOS had from 2.0 all the way up through FF. And
that's all that was left.
Yeah, we had 0.8 through 0.F as the interrupt vectors for the 8259. So that's all I had left.
Yeah.
That's why.
You had to.
Yeah. Well, they weren't happy. Of course, all the money we were sending them for.
Yeah, they're not complaining.
Did that help? Smallify them?
Although I have to say, I remember in those days, Andy Grove didn't like anybody. He was mad at everybody. He was mad at you. He was mad at Microsoft. He was mad at everybody.
Now, I've met Andy Grove only once at the 20th anniversary dinner, and I was sitting at the same table that he was. And his wife said to me, you know, Andy doesn't normally laugh at anything, but when he read the quote in the San Jose Mercury News where you shared the credit for control all with Bill Gates, he laughed.
Yeah, I bet he did.
So that's why I actually used the line later on when we were up on stage.
I have that video. I should play that video so that you get full credit for that. Let me see if I can find it because I think it's on YouTube.
It's in lots of places. If I could do just a little bit of setup, 20th anniversary celebration of the IBM PC held in San Jose at the Computer Museum, and they had 8 representatives of the PC industry up there. There was me, there was Dan Bricklin, Rod Canyon, founder of Compaq, David Bunnell, PC Magazine guy, Andy Grove, Bill Gates, Ray Ozzie, and Mitch Kapoor, Lotus 123, were up there on the panel. And so I get the first question. Control Alt Delete. What were you thinking?
And I'm still waiting for YouTube to load. I was hoping you'd stretch that set out. I've had a long time. While I'm loading that page, let me ask you: Are you at all surprised when? I mean, as far as I know, at least some of the code survives on in every PC that's made. Is that not the case? I mean, not exactly, but the choices that you made and so forth.
I would like to say that's because of the extremely wise choices that I made back in 1980, but in reality, it's the compatibility problem.
Right.
Legacy. PE2 still runs because right. all those compatibility points have been maintained.
Well, I'm going to say it was because you did such a good job.
Well, you know, I like to think that.
Well, and I agree. But do you think that, where do you stand on backwards compatibility and how important it is? Because there's always been and always will be an ongoing argument about how far back to go. And, you know, Apple with OS X made a decision to just kind of throw everything out. That seems to have worked out for them. But Microsoft has tried to ease people along and keep things compatible.
Because of our experience in the original versions of the PC, when the XT came out, one of the things we found out is we actually had to have the entry points at exactly the same location.
Hmm.
Not just the same function, but its entry point, because somebody had written a program that right. used it there. So we actually got in trouble because, you know, we published the BIOS listings for the XT, and one of the lines, it says, unnatural act to maintain compatibility.
That's in the code?
Well, that's in the comments.
In the comments,
that's
yeah.
That's so funny.
It's well-commented code, I have to say.
Yeah, well, let me assure you that the comments went in after the code was running, not as I was writing, for the most part. So another issue with the original PC compatibility, you wouldn't even think of this, but there was a slot in the back of the PC about 2 inches long and half an inch high that you could run cables out of. For example, if you wanted to do a light pen, which could plug into the color graphics card. People got mad when we took that out. So what I found was you need to keep everything working the same. Remember the big PC Junior controversies?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, these programs run on the Junior?
Yeah.
And we went to great lengths to try and make sure everything could to the extent possible. Junior only had one diskette drive, and its video was a little bit different, so there were some concessions, but we tried to make sure everything would work the same. So I'm in favor of carrying that all along. People have learned how to work around those holes in the memory caused by the video graphics adapters and stuff, so let's just keep doing it, because I want to still run PE2.
Yeah. Well, you get used to something, and it works, and you don't want it to change. Hole in the back that you're talking about for light pens, people were using that for all kinds of things, and whatever it was they had figured out to use it for, they didn't want it to go away.
Here's Dave on stage.
Actually, I was just trying to solve a development problem that we had. Brand-new hardware, brand-new software, you're testing the stuff out, it would hang up all the time. So the only solution you have is turn the power off, wait a few seconds, turn the power back on, and... you know, wait for it to go through the power on self-test. I said, I'm writing all this code for the keyboard. I can, you know, let's just shortcut it. And I originally intended for it to be what we would now call an Easter egg, just something we were using in development. It wouldn't be available elsewhere. But then the pubs people found out about it. And they're trying to figure out how to tell somebody to start up one of the programs, and they had the answer. Just put the diskette in, hit Control-Alt-Delete, and by magic your program starts. So... it was like a 5-minute job in doing it. I didn't realize I was going to create a cultural icon when I did it. but you know, I have to share the credit. I may have invented it, but I think Bill made it famous.
You got a big laugh, and I don't think Bill was all that happy when you said that.
Yeah, I would invite your viewers to actually go where they can see the clip, because Bill does a great reaction shot. Yeah, you've got it right.
Yeah,
there. Bill's
yeah.
reaction shot. Plus, right after I say cultural icon there, sitting right next to me is Dan Bricklin, one of your previous
sure.
guests.
Sure. Love Dan.
I
of course.
I think we high-fived or something at that point.
Yeah. 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 There it is.
Yes.
Dan's wearing his trademark lumberjack shirt. That's how I knew. He's got the flannel plaid on.
If you see some of the other clips from that, in the wider
awesome.
Shot, you can see that Dan was there.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Good line. Well done, David.
Well, you can thank Andy Grove for that also. He laughed at it.
So here we are. It's hard to believe 100 years later, IBM, you know, is famous for the guys in the skinny black ties, the white shirts, for the slogan Think, for the songbook, the IBM songbook. Was any of that still around when you joined IBM in the early 80s?
We didn't gather around to sing Ever Onward IBM, but suit, tie, white shirt, all of us engineers dress that way.
Sure.
And of course, it wasn't unique to IBM. If you look at the old NASA footage from the Apollo days,
that's right.
The way they
that's
were dressed.
Right. Yeah.
It was like that until the middle 90s that we didn't wear a coat and tie to work every day. So IBM was very much that way. It was a very traditional company to work for back when I joined in 1975.
And it has reinvented itself many, many times.
It's a different
over
company,
100
I
years.
Think.
It's, yeah. It's become many different companies, right. from scales to typewriters
True.
To mainframes, and now it's a services
True.
Company.
Yeah.
And you're leaving out the Browning automatic rifles that they made during World War II.
I wow. didn't know about the Browning
didn't
automatic
know about that
rifles.
Either.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Wow.
Well, you know, during World War II, virtually all industries shifted into war.
Sure, so that makes sense.
IBM's contribution.
Now they're primarily a software and services company.
Mm-hmm. And Sam Palmisano did run the PC company for a while.
Right.
I was in meetings with him way back when, generally because something wasn't working right, and I was along with a group of people trying to explain what was broken and why it was going to be fixed tomorrow, sort of thing.
Do you ever have reunions of the Dirty Dozen, the original 12?
No, first of all, we didn't call ourselves the Dirty Dozen.
That's a terrible name.
It was a decent movie, though.
it was a good movie.
Particularly Jim Brown.
Yeah, he was awesome. But just, you know, that's media. That's the media, isn't it? We need a catchy name. We
need some alliteration.
Yeah. Slogan. Just can't call you the original IBM PC team. That's
yeah, well, and part of the deal was that was in September of 1980. By October, more people were coming on board, more in the engineering group. Of course, you got a programming team, marketing, sales, right. all that sort of stuff already in place. So the 12 didn't last very long. IBM has an internal, or did at that time, have an internal glossy magazine called Think. And on the first anniversary, they ran an article, and they mentioned 12 original engineers, which is where the mythology, I believe, began. So at that point, we all tried to figure out who the original 12 were. And fortunately, one of the 12 was smart enough to get everybody's autograph on that page of his Think magazine.
Ah, well done.
He's the one who's got the real artifact of that time. But we quickly grew to 20, 30, 40
right.
engineers over time, and everybody was working 10, 12 hours a day getting the thing out.
Of course, Don Estridge and his family died tragically just shortly thereafter that in a plane accident.
I want to say 83 or 84.
Yeah, just a few years later.
It was the Delta jet in a microburst from a thunderstorm going into Dallas-Fort Worth.
Yeah. But your creation, his creation, lives on absolutely in every computer that is sold today, and it's pretty darn amazing.
Well, it was the right product at the right time. I think that's about the best way you can describe it. There was a lot of pent up demand, and remember, in 1980, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM.
I do remember that.
So IBM brings out a personal computer.
Yep.
It's now okay to buy personal computers.
Absolutely.
I'd like to think it was because of the excellent design and implementation we did, but the name certainly counted for a lot.
But you validated the business, and that was the key there. You made it okay. Now, it looks like this PS2 boots.
This PS2
are you running
has not been modified in any way since I bought it in 1989. It not only boots, but it runs DOS Shell and Windows 286.
Wow.
And it's impressive. It's the original motherboard. It's the original graphics card. All the ports are the same. The floppy disk is dead on it. That's the only thing that's given out.
I think I have a way of showing it. Let me see on screen. There it is. Yeah. So, Windows 286, application programs, file system, command prompt. Man, that oh, you even have PC DOS on there. Not that interloper MS DOS.
No. This was bought from International Business Machines.
Dave, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. It was fun.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll talk again in another 100 years.
Okay.
Maybe sooner.
Maybe sooner. Thanks, Dave.
Dave Bradley, the creator of Control Alt Delete, but really much more importantly, the guy who wrote the original BIOS for the original IBM PC in 1981 and started a revolution thereby. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, that is such... I love going down memory lane, I have to say.
Well, there's so many interesting stories about how this stuff got created, how it got named, how it came about. And then it starts bringing up all these things that you forget about, like sys commands.
I can't believe I remember that.
Yeah.
And pip, that was how you copied files. Remember pip?
I don't remember pip.
Oh, yeah. You couldn't... There was no copy A to B. You had to pip. And I think it was B to A. It was very confusing, the pip command. Here, we'll play one more time this video, and this time we'll have the picture. I don't know what was going on this. This is David Bradley responding to the question about control. No, that's not it.
That's not it.
Don't you feel like it wants to say something?
It does. It's just blinking, waiting to talk.
It just feels like there's something. It's going to say something.
Yeah. A minute now. My TI-99 could talk.
Here's David.
Brand new software. You're testing the stuff out. It would hang up all the time. So the only solution you have is turn the power off, wait a few seconds, turn the power back on, and... You know, wait for it to go through the power on self-test. I said, I'm writing all this code for the keyboard. I can, let's just shortcut it. I originally intended for it to be what we would now call an Easter egg, just something we were using in development. It wouldn't be available elsewhere. But then the pubs people found out about it, and they're trying to figure out how to tell somebody to start up one of their programs, and they had the answer. Just put the diskette in, hit Control-Alt-Delete, and by magic, your program starts. So... It was like a 5-minute job in doing it. I didn't realize that I was going to create a cultural icon when I did it.
There's Dan Bricklin. Right to his left, Dan Bricklin in the trademark plaid flannel shirt. Oh, and YouTube is just killing me today. I think it's this machine. I should be using a PC. If I were using a PC.
If you had an IBM.
I need an IBM.
5150. Mm-mm. Wouldn't be having these problems.
Those were the days, my friends, we thought they'd never end.
I meant to ask David. It was a silly question, so I didn't want to interrupt him at any point, and I didn't get a chance. But if 5150 is the code for crazy, if they thought about that when they named the PC 5150.
Whoops.
It's police code.
I think they didn't. So hit return. I want to see. Let's go back to DOS.
You want to go back to command?
Yeah.
Line? Okay.
There's no copy. You can't type copy. It'll go, huh? It wants to do pip. Yeah. Oh, no, it does no copy. See, that's a later version of DOS.
It was DOS 4.
Maybe pip was CPM and DOS new copy.
Pip?
Yeah. Pip must have been CPM.
There you go. That makes sense.
Well, we're never going to get back to this video. It's just, God, it's just really annoying.
Bill Gates is doing that, you know.
Bill does not want anybody to see that.